Hi, everyone. You're listening to yet another edition of the Spodcast, a podcast with a name that we really can't agree on at all. I'm joined by Alex and Chris here, who probably have diverse and varying opinions on the name Spodcast.
We still both hate it.
See, I like it, largely because I made the graphics for the Spodcast, and I'm not going to make those again because they took some time. The text effect where it's got like the 3D thing, that was by hand. That was I didn't do any sort of fancy like 3D to 2D stuff. I did that manually because that was ultimately faster because I don't know how to do the 3D stuff. So yeah, I'm not messing with that shit again. So we are the Spodcast. And it's been a couple weeks since we did one of these. And really the most interesting thing that has happened in those past couple of weeks is that for the first time in, I think, 12 years, we have new Star Trek on TV, which is to say not actually on TV, but airing on the internet such as it is.
So I'm still confused about that, because I don't have traditional cable, and I don't get any network channels over the air. So does it straight up only air on their streaming service? There is no way to get this show on TV?
I think at least part of the first season is airing on CBS, the actual channel, but not right, like later on. Let's see here.
And then in other countries, I think it's different too.
Debuting on CBS and All Access on September 24th. So I don't know what that means. That sounds like it's on actual television.
Canadians can watch it on Space Channel or Crave TV, which is like the Bell media streaming
yeah
service.
Okay, so it was simulcast on the CBS All Access streaming service and on the CBS channel and on Space and on Crave TV and on Netflix if you're not in North America, which great, wonderful, thanks. Yet more reason for me to want to set up a VPN so I can pretend to be in like South Korea or something and get all the good Netflix shit. I don't actually know if South Korea has any good Netflix shit or any Netflix shit at all, but somewhere that no. Is not here.
So according to Wikipedia, it straight up is the rest of the 15 episode first season will be streamed weekly on All Access. Yeah. I don't know if it actually appears on TV. That's fascinating. That sounds really risky, actually. A platform that is just now launching, that has no established user base, basically being carried by one TV show.
Yeah, they're doing the Voyager thing again. So I don't know if you remember, but when Voyager launched, like Star Trek Voyager, the series launched in 1996, I think.
And it was streamed over Real Player?
No, it... I don't even think Real Player existed at that point. Not as a thing you could use on the internet anyway. No, it launched as the flagship of the UPN, if you remember that network, that it totally still exists and did not fail. And it was kind of like, because all the other previous Star Trek series, and including like Deep Space Nine, which was running concurrently at the time, were just syndicated. So it was just local networks picked them up. And then Voyager was specifically just UPN, at least at the start. And they kind of used Star Trek to prop up their new network, which like probably worked to some extent, just because at the time Star Trek was a really big deal. I mean, this was like a year after The Next Generation stopped airing. They were getting ready to do the Next Generation films. In fact, they were already filming the Next Generation films. It probably helped UPN, at least in the short term, and then it just turned out that like there wasn't a whole lot of other content for that thing. But like, I wonder at doing that now, you know, when the last Star Trek series was 12 years ago and it was the really not great Enterprise.
I mean, it certainly looks like a show that could carry a application for like a little bit, but
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess we can talk about that. Like, the production values of this thing are ridiculous. Like, it looks
at times
better than the Abrams movies. You know, I think they're like $8 million per episode, which is, like, pretty crazy.
Like, it's weird, though, because, like, there are points where it looks like a film. And then there is, like, occasionally, like, an obvious TV approach to solving a problem. Like, occasionally screen shake is just shaking the camera. And it's really weird to go from, like, film-level production CGI, and then something will hit the ship, and then they'll just shake the camera, and you're like, wait, this doesn't look as good.
I didn't notice that, actually, but I'll be, like, looking out for that from now on, because that sounds really funny if they're still using the old method of, like, okay, all the actors just kind of, like, shake around, like, as if you're... the ship is moving. Fuck, they didn't even do that with like back in the TNG film, like the last TNG film, Nemesis. They actually put the bridge set on a like motion thing so they could rock it when you know you needed a battle sequence and the ship like got hit and people were being thrown around. That's really interesting if it's just like a fucking camera shake. Although I guess like how practical is it to build an entire set on a, you know, on a rocker? Like, do they even do that with the Abrams movies? Like, I don't know. Let's kind of dive into it. Star Trek Discovery. What did you guys think about it? I've seen both episodes. Alex has seen both episodes, and Chris, you've seen the first one. And I say both episodes. The third episode is like coming out as we're recording this, so we haven't seen that yet. And I should probably add that this sequence will almost certainly have spoilers in it. So if you haven't seen it and you care about spoilers, then maybe skip this segment until you do. But the two-part pilot. The movie pilot will say. What'd you guys think?
Maybe Chris go first?
Okay. I've only seen half of it. So that is going to hamper my ability to really comment because I know a lot of the interesting plot stuff happens on the back half. That said, what I saw, I mostly really, really liked. I like mixing traditional Star Trek problems and politics with a more personal viewpoint of a single character. So far, at least, that seems to be working. I like not having necessarily it be the captain that we're following and the captain being the main character. That's refreshing. I am digging... Again, the production values are astounding. And it seems like it's going for a nice mix of action-y, sci-fi, popcorn TV with a decent dose of actual Star Trek-y, like... How do we handle an interesting situation in a cultured and reasonable way without being just like, blasters on, let's do some space shit. So I liked it, but I can't speak to the overall thing because I haven't finished the second half of it.
Yeah, it certainly feels a lot more like laid back and thoughtful and a little bit more cerebral in its approach to stuff. Like, even though it's dealing with a very like explicitly like the... This is the start of a war between the Federation and the Klingons. Like, this is the backstory we're doing here. You know, this is the point in the canon that we're going to explore. But like, at no, like, everything about it feels like slower and more methodical than the Abrams films and the you know, I guess they're not all Abrams films now at this point, but you know, like all three of the new Trek films are very, very fast paced and like there's very little like stopping and discussing and considering going on, whereas with this thing, even in this fairly, you know, action-packed 2-hour-long pilot, like, there's a lot of, like, considering and thinking and like, how do we handle this situation? What's the best way to do this? You know, Starfleet doesn't fire first kind of stuff going on. And that was like, it was nice to see that as someone who's been kind of watching this develop and looking at the trailers and going like, this kind of looks like it might just be the Abrams films in a TV format, in an HBO miniseries kind of format. And it doesn't seem like it's that. Like, it's definitely not, it's not old Star Trek. It's not the Next Generation. It is more action-y, more drama focused, significantly darker than those series. Like, it's not a return to that form. But I kind of, like, I didn't expect that. I don't know if you can do, like, I don't think you could go and do Star Trek The Next Generation again in 2017. I mean...
I'm actually, like, trying to figure out how to phrase this. There's something about the original, well, not the original, there's something about TNG that almost was like a procedural. Here are these more or less perfect characters stepping through procedure of... diplomatic space adventures. And so it was very much using science, using reason, using diplomacy to solve problems and show that there is another way and that that system works in the same way that Law and Order uses the procedures of investigation and then prosecution to show you that, hey, the law, the legal system works. In some ways, I think Star Trek is a procedural. This is no longer that, or at least the opening movie, I guess, is no longer that. The actual episodic stuff that's coming out now might be closer. But it is definitely, like, more driven by personal interactions. And that's kind of, I think, the biggest difference with original Trek. Because it means that characters have to screw up. Because it's no longer just about that procedural of, we met an unknown space thing. How does a good, civilized society interact with unknown space thing? This is more like, we met an unknown space thing, but so-and-so has been drinking, and so he screws up and fires a laser at it. Now we have to deal with the consequences of that. It tries to mix, like, the personal arcs of the characters with the sort of high-concept sci-fi procedural stuff. And it's going to be interesting to see how that works out, because it means you have to have characters that screw up, like in the intro where... I still don't know the captain's name. Not the captain, the main character's name. Michael?
Michael Burnham.
Yeah.
Where she does the Vulcan pinch on the captain, and I'm like, oh, that's mutiny. She's fired or killed. Like, that's it. That's open mutiny. And I know they're establishing her backstory for the later episodes for what goes on, but at the same time, it's like, you're going to have characters that screw up and do things that are distinctly not Trekkie, because... the series is about characters and their failings and their arcs rather than just how do we solve space problems. And I think that's going to be an interesting needle to thread.
So I'm still really on the fence overall about the series. I would typically with this kind of stuff, it, you know, takes it a while to ramp up, and like, there's no good first seasons of Star Trek. So it's like, may take a season. But like, I really like the first episode because it kind of jumped into things, as opposed to like, we're going to take like 2-hour-long episodes to introduce every character. And like, really, there's still like most of the cast, I don't even know their name. It really just focuses in on, you know, Michael and kind of what she goes through. So, I mean, that's not necessarily bad thing.
Most of the cast hasn't even been introduced yet.
Yeah. Like, even after episode 2. So, I like that it kind of, like, jumped into things, and we're, like, there's still basically no clear understanding of what the premise of the show is. So that's kind of good. But I kind of I don't know about this, the turn of events in the preview of the series that they showed at the end. And I guess this will be like the spoilers
I'm a little put off by it too. I assume you're like, we're talking about like the, like she's a convict now and has to work her way back into the graces of like Starfleet, like that.
Yeah, well, it's that, but it's also like the fact that they kill the captain, and then now the
Yeah.
captain, and like this is me because I didn't follow the casting so much. I heard it's Sandra Oh, right? Sandra Oh. And that they said she was gonna be the captain. I'm like, that's amazing, perfect, wonderful. Like a
No,
woman of
it's
color,
Michelle
like
Yeoh.
oh, Michelle Yeoh, right.
Yeah.
My bad.
I was like, Sandra Yeoh, what are you talking about?
So like I don't keep and I don't follow those kind of things. So when I saw that there was a now it's the white like just another like white dude who we don't even know who he is, and it's like that's kind of shitty. 'Cause I think they showed really good chemistry with those characters, and I don't know if it's like they're gonna make revisit like that or go do more flashbacks, but it seems to me from the series preview that like that's the gist of the story is she's a convict working her way up, and then eventually she gets back on a space ship, and there's this like white dude that's like the captain, and
Yeah, Jason
he's there, and
Isaacs.
I don't know.
It almost feels like the pilot was something that, like, if this were a film or a mini series, it would have probably started in medias res with the beginning of episode 3, which presumably starts with her being like a convict and showing up on the new ship that's the actual main ship. And then you'd get like a couple episodes in, and then you'd get the flashback story of how she got to where she is. And it's interesting that they ended up kind of doing it the other way around. And like the pilot is sort of like, it's not so much a pilot for the show as it is for the the main character's backstory and just her backstory. Saru is the only other major character that I think carries over into the actual rest of the TV show, and he's in that, but he's not really in focus
And
either.
Drew Barrymore looking lady.
Oh, is she on the ship too?
Yes, but she has a cyber mohawk or a side shave thing.
Oh,
But
yeah.
there's cyber in it. And then Daft Punk died, so I guess he won't be
Yeah,
coming back.
why'd they have to kill Daft
Oh,
Punk?
that was the only spoiler I cared about.
no. Well, actually, there's two of them, aren't there?
I don't
I know there's two
know.
Daft Punks, but there's like in this ship, I thought there were two of them, so maybe
I
one
wasn't sure what to
survived.
make of those guys. I think, like, I see a lot of this concern coming up. I've been kind of paying attention to the discussion and the reception of the pilot. And I see a lot of concern about, like, is this just gonna be about the war, and it's gonna be a weird, like, it's gonna be a Star Trek war drama or something, and like how much of the other Star Trek stuff that we love, the uplifting stuff is going to be in it. And like I feel like the pilot kind of was in the position where it had to set this stuff up. Like, this is going to be an overarching conflict for the series, this stuff going on with the Klingons, but like I think there's probably room in there for there to be other stories to explore. You see the kind of stuff like some kind of interesting sci-fi weird stuff going on in the previews for the next episodes after at the end of the pilot. And it seems like there's some element of exploration and element of like going boldly going where no one has gone before, that kind of stuff. So I'm hopeful that like the pilot and the initial like character stuff is not necessarily reflective of like everything that this show is going to be about. Like, Michael is going to get over being a convict relatively quickly, and the show can kind of have that room to explore more than just like, there's a great big war going on with the Klingons, and we gotta go deal with that. And it doesn't it really suck all the stuff that you did and got in trouble for? So I'm hopeful that we see some more of that Star Trek elements, like the classic Star Trek elements, there as it moves into this more episodic format. Obviously, it's not going to be, you know, it is not going to be old Trek. Like, if you were looking for Star Trek The Next Generation again, like, this is not it. If you're looking for the original series again, this isn't really it either. Although the original series was, you know, they had characters that fought and got mad at each other and stuff like that. So, like, some elements of this are similar to that or more aligned with that. You know, they made mistakes. And, of course, they had a lot of red shirts that died all the time. So
I'm just kind of concerned because usually my appeal for Star Trek is seeing a diverse cast doing cool stuff and dealing with differences and similarities and bonding and those moments. And I just, right now, unfortunately, it seems like the only character that they've shown to have chemistry with, the main character, has died.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like it's kind of a shame to...
It was a misstep. I just think it's off.
Yeah, like I think just it's one of those frustrating things where like you have a big, you know, Asian American star, and she's just not a through line. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
it's just disappointing. Even if the captain isn't like the main character of the show, I think there's just such significance now with Star Trek and captains and like legacies and things like that, that it's just hard to avoid.
Yeah, definitely. I do get the sense that the Jason Isaacs captain, like they've been describing him as like, I think Jason Isaacs himself, like said, this guy is the most fucked up captain, we've seen yet. Like, they've been describing him as, like, unhinged and kind of, like, a little bit nuts. And I'm imagining how the central conflict of this season is going to go is that, like, he's going to, you know, bring her out of prison and bring her on to the Discovery, the ship, and like, for her expertise with the Klingons, because she's had history with the Klingons, because they blew up her colony and, you know, attacked her when she was a kid at the Vulcan Science Academy, too, or something. I'm not really sure what the chronology was there. And also she was at the center of the start of the war, and he's going to like kind of mentor her in a way and be like the guy that like kind of reassures her initial assumptions of like, yeah, okay, we actually got to go and just fight the Klingons. And then the evolution is going to be like, he continues to get more and more extreme and ends up turning into like the villain. And I wouldn't be surprised if like the finale is her facing a similar choice that she faced in the pilot of like mutinying, but in this case it's not to go against the captain's orders and potentially start a massive war, but to stop the captain from fucking everything up. And then like I wouldn't be surprised if like going into season two, like there's a different captain, and he's like removed from the picture in some way. That's kind of, that's just a sort of general guess from what I've seen of how I see this possibly going down.
Well, yeah, because they are changing the cast throughout and
yeah,
or throughout the series, but I'd imagine that Michael might be a character that comes back too in a different role maybe.
Oh, did they say they're going to, like the season two is going to be a different, like, cast and setting or
that's
something?
That's what I thought.
I thought that was, like, something that people thought they had said, and then they came back and said, like, oh, no, actually, that's not what we meant. That this was going to be, like, a long-running series with, like, these characters. So the other big question, I guess, is what'd you guys think of the Klingons?
I didn't even... So first, I didn't hear anything about the switch, but of the aesthetics of the Klingons. So when I saw them, I thought they were like a different type of Klingon. from a different like sector or something like that. And then I thought, oh, wouldn't that be cool? Because I also forgot that it was a prequel.
Which actually, you know, actually didn't really easy to forget. Like, there's not a lot.
Yeah, it is. So when I saw them, I thought they were like an alternate from another family or like another house or something. But then it's like just the Klingons, and I'm all for changing the look. I just don't know if this is it. I would have to see like what the series decides to do and portray their culture, and like if there's more to it with definitely like the skin color seems to be a big factor between the light skinned one and the dark skinned ones.
Yeah.
So maybe they're gonna do something like with that, and that's less maybe likely to do with the original design that they've been working with for so long. I don't know, but I'm not against or for it until I see what they do with it.
Yeah, the Klingons were always sort of depicted like across all of their depictions as having generally darker skin tones than you know, not the average human being, of course, but the average human you would see on the mostly European cast of the Star Trek series. But then they also had like white people as Klingons, so you know it wasn't like ever a brought up as any sort of a big deal in the past. Whereas in this one, like there's some specific thing like this guy's an albino, and so people shun him. But then the Klingon Messiah figure, whose name I forgot and probably can't pronounce, T'Kuvma or something, like. You know, recognizes him as you know, a courageous person and gives him a position of authority. I am apparently in the minority in that I actually really dig the new Klingon look, with a few caveats that I'll get to, but like it's not so far away from what the Klingons used to look like that it looks like, oh, this is a completely different fucking like thing. Like they still look Klingon adjacent. They're just like they've got a bit more prosthetics going on the face. You know, they're a bit stockier and bigger, and they're wearing like really ridiculous looking armor now. But like I think they did a decent job of like, you know, like, hey, we just sticking a rubber forehead on someone doesn't really look that great in 2017. What can we do to like make the Klingons look a little bit more distinctive and still kind of keep the general aesthetic that had been established in the movies and then, you know, in through the Next Generation and so on. And I think they did a pretty good job of that. I do kind of miss the hair, but I guess that like I feel like the shaved head stuff is maybe something specific to this particular sect of Klingons that we're interacting with. Cause like some of the holograms of Klingons seem to have hair, when all the great houses showed up. The one problem I have with the Klingons is that like it's seems like maybe the makeup is a little bit too heavy on the actors. Cause there's a lot of like, it feels like you're losing quite a bit of emotion going on with some of these scenes where the Klingons are just kind of like staring blankly and there's not a whole lot of facial movement because they're wearing such heavy makeup. And I wonder if that was maybe just like the one main Klingon that we see the most of doing that. And then later on it'll look different. I'm not sure. I thought it was really cool that, they really committed to like whenever the Klingons are speaking English, they're actually speaking English, and when they're not, they're speaking in Klingon with subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty neat, although I think they maybe could have sped up the enunciation a little bit.
Yes, they talk so slowly
because it was going like Tokuk Nuk Farnetto. And like that was, and it kind of made all the sentences drag on a lot. And I think they were speaking the actual Klingon language. I don't know for sure, but like there is an actual Klingon language that has a grammar and vocabulary.
Oh, they must be.
Like you would think, you know, if you're doing that much dialogue in this fake language, you'd probably use the actual fake language rather than just writing gibberish. But I thought that was really neat. I don't think I think they got the culture right. Like, it didn't feel, like, it didn't feel really out of the ordinary, the kind of stuff that the Klingons were talking about. You know, they've always kind of sort of been that individualistic, you know, warrior society. And it makes sense that, you know, they're probably busy warring against themselves most of the time. The one thing that didn't make a whole lot of sense is that I felt like the actual argument to come together was pretty weak and didn't make a whole lot of sense. Where, like, the thing that got all the other Klingon houses to join together and fight was the captain saying they come in peace. And it was like,
yeah, that was a bit of a stretch.
Like, look, here, they're gonna say they come in peace. We come in peace. They're lying. Okay, we'll fight with you. It's like, I didn't understand the, like, line of reasoning that led to the, like, to everybody just going, yeah, that's it. They said they come in peace, so fuck those guys. Like,
if they really weren't in, like, that much conflict, then why set it up that way? Like, if that was the thing, you know what I mean?
Right. You feel like any Klingon watching that would say, like, well, duh. You know, oh, so they put a nice spin on it when they're coming to defend their territory. So what? So that was the one thing that kind of came out as weak to me, was like the T'Kuvma, the main Klingon, is supposed to be this like messianic figure who talks about he's the second coming of Kalis, the sort of Klingon Jesus. And I kind of expected, like, for a religious zealot character to have more of a solid, like, charisma to him. And it didn't feel like he was quite there to me. But yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic about this show. It did a lot of stuff that I was expecting to see less of. You know, there was a lot more nuanced discussion of things going on, a lot more interesting problems than the typical new Star Trek movie. They're the bad guys. They have a doomsday weapon. We gotta kill them. So I'm interested in seeing where this goes. I'm not totally completely sold on it yet, but I'm pretty happy with what I saw for a pilot episode. It's probably the best Star Trek pilot in all of the Star Trek series.
Oh, you think so?
Like, what pilot was better? Like, Caretaker was okay. Emissary was pretty good. No, Encounter on Farpoint was probably the worst. Like, I actually probably would say Broken Bow is higher than Encounter on Farpoint, and Broken Bow sucked.
Like, yeah, the only that's good a good thing point. About, there's not many good ones.
The only good thing about Farpoint was John DeLancey as Q. That's about it. Where No Man Has Gone Before was pretty good, I guess. Although Bones wasn't in the series yet, so it can't win. Any closing thoughts?
I want to see the second half of it. It didn't immediately turn me off.
High praise indeed.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Cool. So we've been going for about 40 minutes. What do you say we go and do some mailbag questions?
Okay.
Sounds good.
We have a number of them. I'm gonna read a couple of these subject titles to give you an idea of the kind of response we got from the last Spodcast. You asked for it. Erotic question.
Oh, no. I forgot we did that.
Spodcast question of an erotic nature. Not an erotic question, sadly. And then something about Dishonored, Death of the Outsider.
And, oh.
Some other stuff.
So he baited us, or she, or they.
Well, no, this is just subject titles of different emails that I got.
So, but they thought maybe they would put erotic questions so we'd get interested.
I don't know. I've actually read all of these. Do we want to do erotic questions or non-erotic questions? What kind of line do we want to
go back and forth between the two? Well, I mean, I don't know what these questions are.
All right. Do we want to start with an erotic question, or do we want to lead off with a non-erotic yes. question and get everybody kind of interested first? All right.
Sex sells.
Cool. I agree. Okay. Let's go with. There are kind of two questions of a similar nature here. I'm going to read this one, and then we can probably read the second one and kind of compare the two. Dear spoily folks, in response to the call for erotic questions, have any of you tried games funded via Patreon? Trials in Tainted Space has had a successful backing for what is effectively a text adventure, and Cloud Meadow seems to still be a thing after the breeding season fiasco. Side note, what breeding season fiasco? Last I heard, they were still going. What happened? What are your thoughts on games funded this way? I also have a game suggestion. I'm about halfway through Binary Domain and would love to hear your thoughts. Think Marlowe Briggs as a third-person shooter with squad loyalty meters that are based on voice commands. Seriously, you control your squad with voice commands. It's amazing. Philip. I'm highly skeptical of a video game where you control anything with voice commands.
I remember they had one, what was it, for when the PS2 first came out? That was like one of the first games.
Really? Like, I remember, like, SOCOM series being the thing that popularized, like, voice over, for multiplayer stuff. But that wasn't, like, controlling voice commands.
Lifeline by Konami.
Oh, that wonderful game company. I've never heard of this game. What the hell is it?
It's a game where you control the player by speaking to them on the microphone.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
I would love to see how this actually plays.
We gotta go and find a copy of that and a headset that'll work with it and like set it up and live stream it.
XPlay gave it a 2-star out of 5-star.
So I don't think I've played an erotic game in years. I think the last time I played an erotic game was like I was in college, and it was like I was plumbing the depths of bad DOS games, and I found a strip poker game, and the cards were all weighted to give you like way more full houses and way more flushes and stuff than are statistically likely, just so you regularly win and the nudity continues. I think that's the last erotic game I remember playing, and it was not very good because it wasn't a very good poker game, and it was a DOS game, so the nudity was very pixelated. So it wasn't great as an erotic work either. But yeah, I don't play a ton of erotic games. It's not like I don't know. The concept's always been weird to me.
Question was about Patreon.
Yeah,
erotic games funded through Patreon.
To the point where I'm not So I haven't played Cloud Meadow is my point, and I haven't played any of the others that are supported. So my point is, I don't think I can talk of with any level of knowledge about any of these titles and whether or not the Patreon funding model works for them.
Well, that's never stopped the
Like I can
rest of
speak of,
us.
well, I can speak about whether I think Patreon works as a game dev funding tool, and I think generally it doesn't unless you're such a small dev that it's literally just keeping your really small projects afloat. I think someone like Kitty Horror Show could probably get by with a Patreon. But games are
Well,
so
there was
long
the
to make that.
thing where the breeding season thing that they mentioned was like a team, and they were like the biggest Patreon campaign on Patreon for a while. We're talking like tens of thousands of dollars a month. I don't know, like I haven't heard of what happened. Let's see. Sex game canceled after taking in five figures a month on Patreon. Oh, this is from like over a year ago. Yeah, they were making $42,300 a month, or yeah,
Wow,
thirty
that
two
is a lot
point
of money.
or yeah. So, and I guess they closed down their. Oh, I remember this now. They had a conflict with one of their art guys who ran off with all the art assets and didn't have like a proper fucking contract of like, hey, we own the art assets that you make for this game.
Oh,
And
no.
there was some great big thing about that because I guess making half of six figures a month is not enough to get a fucking lawyer.
So I think there are problems with Patreon funding game development, obviously, especially bigger game devs like that. Like once you're at a point where you're making $32,000 a month, it's hard to release $32,000 worth of content a month. It really, I don't know how that how you could possibly, I don't know how Chris Roberts does it. That's a bad joke. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know how Chris Roberts does it either. Remember when Star Citizen was supposed to come out in like 2014?
So I feel like there's like 18 parts of questions to this. So there's the Patreon as a means of funding erotic games. There's have you played these games? And then there was something about Binary Domain. I also haven't played Binary Domain. Have either of you?
No.
No, I haven't.
I can look into it at some point, and maybe we can do something with it. Yeah, I may be mistaken, but I seem to remember there being a clause in the Patreon terms of service about using Patreon to distribute porn,
But
which
it's not
is
porn, it's
obviously not
vaguely erotic.
enforced because like there's a lot of like erotic fan art Patreons going on, but
Yeah, well, when you fund the artist, they draw whatever they want.
yeah, exactly.
Right? Like it's.
Well, and also where do you draw the line between pornography and sort of pin-up erotic titillation stuff?
Yeah.
And that gets down and I don't want to open up that discussion, but like I don't think you could argue that Cloud Meadow is straight up pornography. It's racy and erotic, or at least from what I've seen of it. Again, I haven't played it, but like, I unless there's like actual hardcore scenes of intercourse in this video game about running a farm, which would be weird. Are there? I hope there's not.
I would not be surprised.
And if it was, how would they regulate that?
It seems to be one of those rules that's in the TOS to protect Patreon, but they never actually bother enforcing.
I mean, it's better that than like what Twitch does, where they just outright arbitrarily ban crap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Twitch's sexual politics is weird.
I have more to say about erotic games in general, but there's another erotic game question that we can get to, so I'll bring it up there. In the meantime, do we want to move on to a non-erotic question?
Sure.
Let's see, what would be interesting here? Okay. Dear Spodcast, did Josh accept defeat and name it Spodcast?
Okay, that's a bad question because...
confused about who would be accepting defeat. Actually, you know what? No, I surrender. Oh, no. I guess we have to call it the Spodcast now, and there's no reason ever to bring it up again. Moving on. Real question. Dishonored Death of the Outsider ends differently than the previous two Dishonored games in that instead of it being related to the actions that the player committed over the course of the game, the ending was decided directly by the player in the last few minutes. Do you guys have any thoughts over a game's ending being directly related to player choice versus player action?
Yeah, I guess I do. I think finding a good ending
also
is
real. Cheers, Maddie won Monopoly. Sorry, continue.
I feel like the best endings are ones that can look at your play experience holistically, but do not result in an ending based on the same choice over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. For example, I'm not a big fan of Infamous, and I'm not a big fan of Bioshock's do you harvest or not harvest little sister mechanics. I'm also not a big fan of the original Dishonored's do you do things not killy or do you do things really killy approach to calculating whether you have a high or low chaos run. Because that boils down to making the same decision over and over and over again, and the entire video game becomes a very complicated, are you sure, yes, no option on which ending you pick, and that is not super interesting. I like things like the end of like Fallout New Vegas, where we run through all of your choices as a player and talk about the impact of the characters and what that meant and what that did, and get a holistic picture of what you as a player did to that game world. In a pinch, I'm okay with like choosing the actual ending at the very end of the game, because you can use what you've learned throughout the entire game to inform your decision. Look at something like Deus Ex for a good example of that. So I think the worst, my least favorite kind of endings are the ones where it's like there's only two options and you just have to keep playing a certain way or making a certain choice over and over and over and over and over again until the end of the game. That kind of sucks. I like the best, my favorite are the ones that look at all choices like Fallout. And my second favorite is something like Deus Ex, where it goes, using what you've learned, make an informed decision. So that's my rant about that.
Yeah, I feel like the systems that are like, we try to systemize it. We have this thing that keeps a tally on what you're doing, and we give you a score at the end of the game. Those tend to like be really, really bad most of the time. And not really reflect a lot of like the nuance of the actions. You know, if it's just like killing is bad, then you kind of set up a situation where there's no context wherein killing is justified, and that kind of creates a weird dichotomy where like, hey, maybe this guy would hurt a lot more people by still being around, so let's kill him. And then, you know, it's oh, well, you killed him, and that added to your chaos score. I realize, like, Dishonored always has non-lethal options for dealing with people, but it's that kind of thing of, like, there's no... like, if you're just automating it and doing it based on, like, some kind of score tally, you're going to run into situations where it just erases the nuance of the choices that you're actually making. And generally does lend itself to this, like, great, big, grandiose, like, good or bad dichotomy where there's not really any kind of... gray area. So I'm not a huge fan of systems like that. I feel like if you could keep track of enough things, if you could like make a karma system that really actually paid attention to a lot of the stuff, you know, like what, how do you tend to handle people in dialogue choices, you know, like you know, how do you tend to handle combat situations, do you try to, you know, go above and beyond what people ask and like, you know, give to the poor. And I'm using this in context of like RPG choices and stuff like that, you know, like what general impact are you having on the world with a series of multiple different scores? And you could find a way to, like tally those out into a specific kind of outcome. I feel like that could work, but I don't think I've ever seen a system do that in a satisfying way. I feel like, yeah, the best way that has been done to do it is the approach that like Fallout kind of pioneered. Like Fallout 1, Fallout 2, and New Vegas all had this like, you know, here's specific areas, specific characters, specific quests, and how your choices in those things affected the world and the people in it. And that maybe leads into like what choices you have in the ending or not.
I think part of the reason that we keep coming back to Fallout is that those are really, really scripted endings. And if you do it with a system, no matter what, you're going to boil it down to your choice. Your impact on the game world was these numbers. But to make that meaningful, you really eventually have to frame that in a way that is written. And so many game systems just end up being like, well, if it's below this threshold, you got ending A, and you got above this threshold, you got ending B. Or maybe below this threshold, ending A, middle would be B, and above this threshold is C. Tends to be about how much writing we do. Where Fallout, as a game that is an RPG, really focuses on like actually writing that stuff out for each town and each major faction or whatever, giving you a summary of what your impact really was. Is a lot more interesting. So at the end of the day, to do an ending to a game, you're going to have to translate game state to something somebody sat down and wrote for it to be meaningful. Because otherwise, you're just going to go, it's a mission complete summary screen. You know, you got 37% happy in this town, and like, who cares about that if you're going for a satisfying narrative conclusion? So
I think that it's less about the character, like the choices, and more about the characters that are making that choice. So I think a lot of the games we have problems with kind of like they try to have a character in the world and but have it like also be kind of how you might think they act, so either like an aggressive version or like a kinder version, when I think like it really works best when you're either completely constructing your character from scratch, so like Fallout sort of does this, or like, you know, for a more recent example, like Divinity kind of do that too, where there's suggestions, but really you can make the character kill whoever you want or play however you want, and that's just a system that it's in the game, but it's also narratively in your head a little bit too. You're creating it. And then of course the games where there's just no choice, and then you have characters that are just seen through to the end by the writing and the story. And I think that games are at this point where we're having trouble blending the two. The sort of character, but also sort of you. And I don't know if we have a system yet for it.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
You've got a lot of games like the Dragon Age game, or BioWare games in general, where you kind of, you're making a character ostensibly that is a new character that is unique to you, but by the very nature of the kind of story they're trying to tell and the methods they're using to try to tell it, like that character has to have some sort of characterization in the world, and
especially
and
so if you have it voice acted,
right? Exactly.
Because right off
voice
the bat,
acting
you're,
is the big thing.
You know,
because if it's voice acted, you can't just have them doing monotone stuff. You know, you can't do the text thing of having the character just speak in text and like you can kind of read your own tone into it. And if you're doing any kind of cinematic stuff, you know, of course you have to have some kind of characterization for the character, and that is not unique or created by the player at all most of the time. Sometimes there's a little customization options. You know, if your character's got a lot of renegade points, they can be mean to people, you know, stuff like that. But it's a very weird sort of position, which is kind of why I found myself gravitating to like more set characters like Geralt in the Witcher series, Adam Jensen in the new Deus Ex games, that are specifically and explicitly established characters. These are people. They have their own backstory. You don't pick that. You role play that particular character, and then you get to shape their actions and the way those actions inform that pre-existing character through the course of the game. And then you have things like Corvo, who is ostensibly a real person but has no personality whatsoever, and doesn't even speak in his first game.
He's just so busy killing.
All right, let's go to another erotic question. It's the actual subject of this is, you asked for it, erotic question. Well, you guys asked for it, so here it is. Are you aware of the homebrew erotic game genre? If so, have you played any? You can find many examples here, and it's a link to tfgamesite.com. Most of these games never get completed, but there are some really good ones amongst the barely a demo garbage. They tend to be free to play, but a couple have even managed to get decent Patreon funding for the regular updates. Just wanted to hear your thoughts and possibly horrified stories on this topic. I particularly can't wait to hear Rutskarn's take on it. Rutskarn is busy today, so I guess you'll have to put up with me. Thanks for the podcast, Hayev. So I will, full disclosure here, all of our erotic questions are about erotic video games and whether we played them. So I guess, Kamsu, your answer is going to be the same regardless. I have...
So, like, my... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, well, I've kind of dipped my toes into erotic games a bit. I am by no means an expert, but my conclusion is that they are all shit, like, across the board. Pretty much none of the ones that I've tried have been particularly good, either in terms of, like, just straight up, like, here's porn, or in terms of, like, this is, you know, smut with, you know, plot or whatever. And you've got, like, a couple of different variations on, like, adult games, and all of them have, like, horrible crippling problems. Like, you've got, like, the Newgrounds, really shitty flash games that, like, have some bad side-scroller gameplay, and then there's some sex scenes. Those are not particularly interesting. You know, you run into the thing of, like, well, you know, you could just be looking at porn and then you wouldn't have to deal with playing bad gameplay. And then you have the ones that are, like, sort of make your own porn scene, which, again, you know, yay, I'm watching porn where everybody looks like a mannequin and has a dead look in their eyes. Like, I could just go watch actual porn. And then you've got the stuff which are, like, visual novels or dating sims. Well, I guess those are two different kind of things. Like, the dating sims are usually this, like, really horribly creepy time management stuff that gets really tedious. And then the visual novels are, like, monolithically War and Peace word count things, constructs that maybe have a couple of sex scenes in them, and I just get really, really, really bored after reading for, like, 3 hours and nothing has happened. But hey, we're describing the staircase that the self-insert character is walking down right now, so that's great. And it's kind of an interesting set of problems. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I would add that there's, like, another, like, probable, like, version of erotic game, because there's no place, I think, in common knowledge of, like, more educational awareness games. So, like, my mind goes to Robert Yang's games.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've heard of them.
But so, they're more... See, I would almost... They're erotic, but I would almost... Anyway, go ahead. Sorry, I don't want to...
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, so, like, more just, like, more art than anything, maybe. And making a statement about, you know, sexuality and how we perceive male sexuality. And, funnily enough, also, his games are banned on Twitch. So it's course. Just, like... you know, it's just... There's a message there that's just being blanketed by Twitch. Blanket blocked, I guess. Anyways, so there's, like... Or even, like, you think of Christine Love's work, too.
Christine Love is a notable, like, exception, I think. Like, where she actually does do decent erotic stuff, and I've played some of Lady Killer in a Bind, and it does not do the horrible thing of I have been reading for 3 hours and it is exactly as not sexy as it was when I started, and I'm still getting introduced to characters. It kind of jumps right into it. And the game isn't like that long from what I can see.
Yeah, it's about a 5 hour game, but there's multiple endings and stuff. I think it's just a matter of, like, unfortunately, the resources aren't put to making a really good version of the kind of games that we see are often poorly done.
Yeah, you have a very large set of intersecting problems when it comes to making an erotic game. First off, there is the question of, like, who is this for? Is this just porn? Is it more than that? Does it have a plot and then it has porn in it? Is the porn just kind of hinted at and it's really just more smut? A question that, like, and then there's also, like, that element of, like, how do you implement gameplay into that, whereas gameplay is often very much not at all about, there's not a gameplay system that I've seen that, like, really translates to any aspect of romance or sex well, to the point where, like, probably the most successful games are just visual novels because they don't have gameplay mechanics. And then, of course, there's the issue of, like, up until recently, like, you couldn't even have games with sexual content on Steam. It's really hard to sell these things and make money doing it, you know? And if you're going to be a professional erotic games creator, like, that's not an easy road, even by indie dev standards. And even so, like, right now, like, Steam still occasionally just pulls erotic games for no apparent reason. You kind of got to deal with that. Like, a lot of banking services will not work with you if you're doing, like, explicitly porn stuff.
Really?
There's a huge stigma against that. Yeah, like, PayPal will not work with you if you're doing erotic stuff, as far as I'm aware. Just stuff like that puts a big barrier in the path of making erotic games. So like, the idea of getting, like, a reasonably budgeted, let's, for the sake of it, say, like, a 3D a game, not just some weird, like, I made it in an afternoon side scroller or a visual novel or something where you don't need to worry about graphics and all that kind of stuff. You know, like, getting a decently budgeted 3D game is really hard for that reason. Other problems that I've seen with erotic games in general, like, kind of pulling back, is, like, I think this is something that's not talked about a lot and, like, really should be, is the absolutely pervasive hyper masculinity and misogynistic perspective going on in these games that, like, turns me right off most of the time. It's like all these games were written by frat boys, and, you know, like, video games in general have a problem with, like tackling subjects like this in general in a mature fashion. So this is not unique specifically to erotic games, but, like, it's kind of, I guess, amplified by those other problems we talked about, where, like, writing a really decent fucking dialogue and scenario and anything that's just not just, like, totally trashy is probably, like, even more steps removed from your mind than it would be in any other sort of scenario, just because of all this other stuff that you have to worry about when making an erotic game. And that kind of sucks. Because
there's,
I think it would be
often, like, oh, go ahead.
Well, I think it would be interesting if we saw, more nuanced takes on, you know, games that touched on sexuality in a way that didn't suck in general would be nice. You know, moving even further just from erotic games, you know.
Well, and it's like, it's dealing with the, like, Star Wars prequel syndrome, where it's like everyone's a robot and no one's sexual, and they're all, like,
right.
these desexualized creatures. In so many games we see, and it's like, it's just, it's so hard to even, like, connect with these characters in games that where there's, like, human interaction, but, like, not a lot. It's like strictly business, and it's like, who are these robot people all the time?
You walk into the first tavern in Fallout 3, and there's a prostitute there, and you pay her to sleep with you, and so she walks up, and she goes up into the hotel room, lies down into the bed, and goes to sleep.
Yeah. Well, that's just kind of, I can see that playing off as like a comedic thing.
By a studio other than Bethesda, perhaps.
What are you saying? There's no comedy in the Fallout world?
I'm saying Bethesda doesn't have the self-awareness to do that.
Well, there was that game that came out 2012, the Katawa Shoujo. And I don't know if you guys remember the name, but it's the dating sim where you date different girls with different disabilities. And I never played it to the fullest, but it made me very uncomfortable. But I do kind of wonder if it at least made strides in dealing with, you know, sexuality and disability in maybe, hopefully, at least a few tasteful ways. I can only imagine, like, how it could go wrong, but...
I didn't play it, and I wasn't really sure what to think about it, because, like, half the stuff I heard about it was, like, you know, oh, no, it's making great strides in, like, in you know, the acceptance of people with bodies that are not conforming to the ideal perfect. And then the other half of the stuff I heard was, like, oh, this is, like, fetishizing, like, disability in a really weird way.
I think it was a good conversation starter game.
Yeah.
I think that opening up and talking about how we can incorporate sexuality and like a little bit more in depth is important. And I feel like we're in this kind of odd place because we have a lot of creators that are doing great work, like Christine Love and Robert Yang, but it doesn't seem to be the focus right now when it comes to even a lot of indie devs.
Yeah, and like, I remember there was a game on Steam recently that you know, sounded kind of interesting to me. It was like, I mean, the scenario wasn't all that, you know, unique. It was like, you're at a party, you know, interact with the people at the party, and, you know, and kind of like, do some sort of simulation of, like, dating, and then, you know, that moving into sex, which could, like, I feel like if you could do that right, might be an interesting game. But, you know, it was just full of the same sort of, like, crap. Like, you could just whip your dick out and perform sexual acts and then get kicked out of the party. And it's like, this is not exactly what I was looking for. You know, like, oh, okay, this is also being written by those same people who are writing all these other sex games badly. So, like, I wish there was more like Christine Love that looked at sex in a way that was not the very juvenile, like, haha, like, there's boobs. But we get to show the actual sex act. Yay! But maybe sometime in the future. All right, we've been going for a little more than an hour. I'd say we're pretty good here. We covered most of the erotic questions. You know, if you want to ask,
I guess those
more,
were the important ones.
More erotic questions than maybe something that's not about games.
No.
Because erotic games, they're just not, there's not a lot there.
No more erotic questions. Normal questions, please.
All right. right. Canister wants you to ask normal questions about normal things. And if you want to ask normal questions about normal things, you can always send an email to spoilerwarningshow@gmail.com. And that's a wrap. That's a Spodcast. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Hooray!
I hope we did not horribly disturb you with our discussions about erotic things.
Oh, I held back a ton.
Well, we all appreciate that.
For the sake of Josh's ears.
Yes, my poor, innocent ears. Anyway, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.